Hello everyone. Welcome to the Chester and Flint Talking Newspaper edition for the week ending Friday 19th of June. This is John Sound speaking. I hope all listeners are well and enjoying life. Though somewhat changeable, the weather is generally favourable. As we approach the longest day, we know that summer is just about with us and welcome it, as did, perhaps 800 years ago, the writer of this little poem. Summer is coming in, loads in cuckoo, grows a seed and blows the mead, and springs the wood anew. The text has been slightly modernised, by the way. The original gives details of what the various animals are doing in the fine weather. That was a long, long time ago. I can't help feeling the times have changed even in the last 50 years. I always used to see my first swallow by mid-April, but I haven't seen one this year. When we moved to Upton about 40 years ago, a thrush would always be singing its song three or four times in the trees opposite our house. But there's no thrush around now. When I was a lad in Cumbria, about 80 years ago, I remember standing on the front doorstep, absolutely thrilled by flights of swifts coming screeching low down along the street to a sandstone house where they nested. Not nowadays. The house isn't even there. This year, I may have seen a swift high up in the sky, but I can't be sure. For several years after our move to Chester, we had regular garden visits from three colourful jays, from the occasional woodpecker and an inquisitive sparrowhawk, as well as a faithful little wren. One day, I even had to intervene to save a jay that was being battered by a group of crows. It had to shelter in a bush until it recovered and flew to safety. There's one advantage, perhaps. It's years since I had to clean my lounge windows because of birds had flown into them, leaving their shape on the pane. The blackbirds and, unfortunately, the magpies are still loyal visitors. I suppose it must be they that knock lumps off my Bramley apples. To quote the USA, you can't depend on nothing. I used to have dozens of starlings on my back lawn and thought them a bit of a pest, but hadn't seen any for years until a few days ago one starling landed and was immediately chased off by a pair of blackbirds before it could find anything to eat. Nature can be cruel, can't it? Perhaps changes in animal behaviour depend more on climate change than we realise. Time will tell. Now, what's been going on locally last week? The local newspaper extracts should give us some idea. Sunrise in Chester on Sunday the 21st of June is 4:44 a.m. and sunset is at 9:42 p.m. And now over to the readers.
Hello, Jan Woodhouse here. A Chester man has been jailed for more than 10 years after he was found guilty of multiple counts of rape. Aaron Furnival of Hunter Street, Chester, has been convicted of four counts of rape at Chester Crown Court on Monday, March the 9th. The 31-year-old had previously pleaded guilty to one count of controlling and coercive behaviour. Furnival returned to Chester Crown Court on Monday, June the 15th, where he was sentenced to 12 years in prison. During his trial, the court was told how the female victim in this case contacted police to report violent behaviour, emotional abuse and sexual abuse committed by Furnival. The woman reported Furnival would take advantage of her while she was asleep and she would awake to find him raping her. She would ask him to stop and he would refuse. Furnival was controlling and jealous. He transferred money from the victim's bank account and monitored her movements with constant phone calls and messages. Furnival used foul and abusive language towards her, made threats to kill her, and even wrote degrading words on her skin in marker pen. Officers arrested Furnival on suspicion of the offences, but during interview he denied the allegations against him. Following an investigation, he was charged. Detective Sergeant Andy Manson said, "Firstly, we would like to recognise the bravery of the victim in this case for reporting what happened to her. We hope that the conclusion of this case and the sentence handed to Furnival will provide her with some sense of closure, knowing that the jury saw through his lies. Furnival's cruel and abusive behaviour showed how he clearly had no regard for the welfare of his victim, doing whatever he wanted, no matter the consequences to her. He then put the victim through the stress of a trial after he refused to accept what he had done. Thankfully, he was found guilty of these crimes and is now facing a considerable length of time behind bars."
Hello, Helen Holyoake here. A probe into cancer rates prompted by concerns over a former landfill site, which is now a beauty spot, found nothing out of the ordinary, councillors are set to be told. A meeting of Cheshire West and Chester's Places Overview and Scrutiny Committee takes place next week, where it will go over the findings of a report looking into cancer rates in Laich. The work was undertaken after concerns were raised by residents and some local politicians over the former landfill site, known as the Backies or Lapper Fields, with fears being raised over alleged higher than average premature death rates in the ward. The Backies was originally a brickworks, and when production ended in the mid-1950s, the old clay pits were backfilled with municipal waste between 1954 and 1965. Most of the site was acquired by Chester City Council in 1980 and maintained as public open space. It is now a 19-acre green space and community nature park, with transformation work being completed last month. A previous investigation found there was no risk to human health, but after the latest concern was raised, a task group was formed to look again at the data, as well as more up-to-date information. The group met twice between January and April this year to review the work carried out by the Council's Public Health and Insight and Intelligence teams in conjunction with the NHS's National Disease Registry Service. Members were also given access to restricted NHS data. Following a review of the findings, a report to the committee said, "Calculating an annual trend of standardised mortality rates for Laich Ward and Cheshire West and Chester back to 2002 showed that while recent years are high, there have also been years where Laich cancer mortality rates are lower than the Cheshire West average." It concluded, "Following analysis of cancer incidence and mortality data for the Laich wards, in comparison with data for the rest of the borough and England as a whole, incidence and cancer mortality in this area is not above that which would be expected."
Hello, Esther Newt here. The owners of a Chester laundrette, which was on fire, have thanked Cheshire Fire and Rescue Service and have given the odd reason for the call out. Fresh Laundry in Charles Street in Hoole needed its door smashing in by firefighters on Monday evening after reports of smoke. Stephanie Williams, whose family owns the laundrette, said the business will open as normal from later on Tuesday. But she explained that the fire was not caused by electrics, a much stranger reason. We're hoping to be open by midday, she said. To be honest, we're quite lucky, as it only needed cleaning up and, of course, a new door. The fire service was amazing in how quickly they responded. My mum came out to see it, and she said they were so kind and they did everything. On that day, someone had brought in tea towels with grease on them from a restaurant for a wash and dry. We think they just spontaneously combusted after the heat of the dry. It happens often. It's our lesson learned that we can't accept that sort of item, as it can happen with massage oils and similar items. Anything that's greasy or oily, you need to be careful. A spokesperson for Cheshire Fire and Rescue Service added, firefighters were called to a report of smoke in a commercial property in Charles Street, Chester. Crews gained entry to the premises and two firefighters wearing breathing apparatus used hose reel jets to put out the fire, which involved a bag of laundry. A large fan was then used to ventilate the building.
Hello everyone, Margaret Bellis here. Plans to demolish three disused buildings in the centre of Chester to create a new five-storey apartment building have been lodged with Cheshire West and Chester Council. The site in Hunter Street, opposite the Story House Theatre, consists of a vacant residential building, offices and a doctor's surgery, together with an associated car park. The buildings, which the application states are in a poor state of repair and beyond reasonable reuse, would be flattened to allow for redevelopment of the entire site. A total of 19 new build apartments would be created as part of a five-storey building, as well as a single dwelling and a 14-space car park. Flats would vary in size, with 4 one-bedroom, 12 two-bedroom and a 3 three-bedroom properties. The separate dwelling would have a minimum of 4 bedrooms. All three buildings had previously been earmarked for demolition as part of earlier Northgate development plans, which had since lapsed. Kirkton House, identified as a non-designated heritage asset, is judged to make limited, if any, positive contribution to the Chester Conservation Area in a planning statement by Cassidy and Ashton on behalf of Pure Residential and Commercial Limited. A summary of public consultation comments lists concerns over scale and the potential of overshadowing, which developers say will be mitigated with a part two-storey, part three-storey design and large separation distances from nearby buildings. The planning statement concludes, the proposal will repurpose a disused site within the city centre of Chester and the Northgate regeneration area.
Hello everyone, Sarah Bell here. North Wales Police could be merged into a larger force under a UK government review, councillors heard on Monday, with the force already arguing it should not be pulled across the border into England. Assistant Chief Constable Nick Evans set out the plans to the North Wales Police and Crime Panel at a meeting in Colwyn Bay on Monday. He said an independent review led by former Metropolitan Police Commissioner Lord Bernard Hogan Howe has been asked to recommend significantly fewer forces across England and Wales. There are 43 forces now. The review was announced on the 17th of March, given 20 weeks, and is due to report to the Home Secretary in August. Mr. Evans said the review would recommend how many forces there should be and which existing forces would be grouped together. For North Wales, the question raised at the meeting was whether the force stays Welsh, joins a cross-border force with the northwest of England, or is merged with the other three Welsh forces. Mr. Evans reported that a Welsh Force Structures Coordination Group, made up of the four Welsh forces and the Commissioner's offices, had submitted evidence to the review by a deadline of the 20th of May, arguing that policing in Wales is different because it operates alongside a devolved Welsh government and that no force should straddle the Wales-England border. Councillor Chris Bithell, a Flintshire County Councillor on the panel, raised concerns heard in Welsh political circles that North Wales could lose its Welsh dimension if grouped with Greater Manchester and Merseyside. The reforms are wider than force mergers. Police and crime commissioners, including North Wales Commissioner Andy Dunbobbin, are to be abolished. A new National Police Service is due from 2027 to take on fraud, cybercrime, forensics and national functions in what Mr. Evans described as a roughly £1 billion organisation. Legislation is expected to become law in 2027.
Hello, I'm Patrick Blandon. More than 12 years after it was made, the overruling of a landmark legal decision involving Chester West and Chester Council has upended the social care sector. The Supreme Court recently overturned its own decision made back in 2014, redefining what constitutes a deprivation of liberty for vulnerable people. The original case was brought on behalf of three people with learning difficulties. The judgment at the time enforced a more absolute definition of what constituted a deprivation of liberty. This led to the establishment of a so-called acid test, which effectively ruled that a person is deprived of their liberty if they are under continuous supervision and control and not free to leave their placement. This had far-reaching ramifications for the vulnerable, their carers, and the wider sector, so much so that the single phrase Cheshire West and Chester 2014 became a phrase pretty much everyone in the care sector would have encountered. But earlier this month, the Supreme Court overruled their original decision and upended the very definition of how a deprivation of liberty is defined. It concluded that instead of relying on a single acid test, an assessment of whether someone is deprived of their liberty must now consider multiple factors. These include their specific situation, the type of restrictions they're subject to, and the person's own wishes. The decision has far-reaching ramifications for Cheshire West and every other council in the country. There is now predicted to be a huge drop in the number of deprivation liberty applications. This could save councils millions of pounds in administrative and legal fees, essentially because fewer everyday care arrangements will be legally classified as deprivation of liberty. Another ramification is how quickly this new decision must be implemented, because the Supreme Court ruling comes into effect immediately. Councils must rewrite their adult safeguarding guidelines in real time, as well as rapidly retrain social workers and other frontline staff. However, a negative impact of the change brings an increased risk of litigation and systemic inconsistency.
Hello from Fiona Farga. Two men have been jailed for 12 months each after carrying out a series of thefts across Chester City Centre in April, targeting shoppers, a charity shop and a parked vehicle within the space of 2 hours. Valentin Botsu, 25, of Walker Close in Bristol, and Laurentio Meccano, aged 40, of No Fixed Abode, were sentenced at Chester Crown Court on the 8th of June 2026. Both men pleaded guilty to 3 counts of theft from the person, theft from a shop, theft from a motor vehicle, 2 counts of attempted theft from the person, and Botsu also admitted possession of cannabis. The offences took place on the 15th of April in 2026, when CCTV operators spotted them in Brook Street heading to the city centre. They were then tracked to Chester Bus Interchange, where Meccano unzipped a woman's backpack and removed a pink carrier bag. Minutes later, both men followed another woman into Tesco on Frodsham Street and attempted to open her backpack, but she turned around and they left. The pair then entered the Cancer Research Shop on Watergate Street and took items of clothing from hangers before leaving. And shortly afterwards, Meccano reached through the open window of a parked Mercedes car and stole a phone from inside. Further thefts and attempted thefts followed before officers, alerted by the CCTV operators, arrested the men on Brook Street. A search of the vehicle they were using recovered a small amount of cannabis. Police Constable Kilshaw said, "Bozu and Meccano both attended Chester with the sole purpose of trying to make a financial gain. They didn't stick to one method of offending. They targeted vehicles, a charity shop, and were even brazen enough to steal from people's bags while they were carrying them." The officer added that CCTV operators in Chester City Centre had been central to securing the convictions. "Their offending was captured and they had no choice but to admit their guilt," he said.
The emergency department at Glanclwyd Hospital has been placed under a formal improvement designation, less than 2 years after a previous round of the same scrutiny ended. Health Inspectorate Wales, the body that checks the quality of healthcare across Wales, has designated the department a service requiring significant improvement. The designation is the watchdog's formal signal that it expects urgent change and will monitor the hospital closely until it sees it. It follows an unannounced inspection in May 2026. The inspectorate said it had concerns about leadership, governance, and the way risk was managed in the department. Glanclwyd in Denbighshire is one of the three main hospitals run by Betsy Cadwaladr University Health Board, which serves Flintshire and the rest of North Wales. The department was under the same improvement arrangement once before, between May 2022 and August 2024. The inspectorate said this latest designation showed the improvements made during that earlier period had not been sustained. The health board accepted the findings in full. In a message to the public, Carol Schillabier, Chief Executive of Betsy Cadwaladr University Health Board, said the decision reflected serious concerns and apologised to patients. "We are sorry that, in some cases, the standard of care has not been where it needs to be for our patients," she said. She added that a strengthened improvement plan was already being put in place, including measures to reduce overcrowding and to make sure patients receive safe care from the point they arrive. She said the underlying problems of patient flow and capacity could not be solved by the health board alone, and thanked local authorities and partner organisations for their help. The inspectorate said patients who needed urgent or emergency care should continue to attend the department. The full inspection report will be published in September 2026.
A petition is calling on the UK government to reject plans for a new gas-fired power station with carbon capture at Connah's Quay. The Change.org petition, started by Timothy Redman, urges the Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero to refuse Uniper's Connah's Quay low-carbon power project. The scheme would see a new power station built on Uniper's land next to the existing Connah's Quay plant, capable of generating up to 1.38 gigawatts, with equipment to capture carbon dioxide and send it into the HyNet network for storage under Liverpool Bay. Because of its size, the project is being decided by the UK government rather than Flintshire County Council, and it is currently being examined by planning inspectors. The petition says the Dee Estuary is one of the most important ecological sites in the UK and raises concerns about air quality, public health, and the visual impact of the scheme on an area that already hosts significant industry. Carolyn Thomas, who was a Labour Senedd member for North Wales until May's election, criticised the project in a post on Facebook. She said, "The planned new construction is massive, totally overbearing on the surrounding landscape. It will impact the Dee Estuary Special Area of Conservation and SSSI, as well as homes, Deeside College and recreation." Councillor Glyn Banks, Flintshire's County Council's Cabinet Member for Waste and Transportation, said carbon capture and storage under the seabed was the industrial equivalent of lifting your carpet and brushing your dust under it. He said heavy industry needed to clean up its act rather than hide its waste for future generations to deal with, adding that the situation showed too much power still lies in Westminster. Flintshire County Council lodged 30 unresolved objections at the final deadline of the examination, covering noise, traffic on Kelsterton Road, wildlife surveys and protected habitats on the Dee Estuary. The examining inspectors now have up to 3 months to send their recommendation to the UK Government, and the Secretary of State for Energy, Security and Net Zero then has up to 3 months to make the final decision.
Flintshire has been confirmed as the site of a new youth hub offering employment, skills and well-being support to people aged 16 to 24. The hub is one of 7 new locations announced for Wales by the UK Government's Department for Work and Pensions. 6 of the 7, including Flintshire, are due to open within the next 2 years. No venue has been chosen and no opening date has been set. Youth hubs move employment support out of the job centre and into community venues such as sports clubs, libraries and colleges. They bring together careers advice, help with CVs and job applications, training and apprenticeship routes, and support with mental health, housing and finances. Anyone aged 16 to 24 can use a youth hub, whether or not they are claiming universal credit. Flintshire is one of 6 Welsh areas in the second year of the rollout, alongside the Vale of Glamorgan, Cardiff, Powys, Monmouthshire and Gwynedd. They follow 13 Welsh areas announced in the first wave, which included the neighbouring authorities of Denbighshire, Conwy and Wrexham. The scheme forms part of a £2.5 billion youth guarantee aimed at connecting every 16 to 24-year-old with work or training. More than 1 million 16 to 24-year-olds across the UK are now not in education, employment or training, a rise of almost 250,000 since 2021. The Department for Work and Pensions said more than half reported a health condition. The Dutch model, which the UK youth hubs are based on, brings employment, housing, health and training support under one roof. The Resolution Foundation has said that if the UK matched the Dutch rate, 600,000 more young people would be in work or education. Mr. McFadden said the UK too often saw young people signed off and written off without engagement or support. He said the country should learn from the Dutch approach of having a pathway for every young person. Employers are being offered a youth jobs grant of £3,000 for hiring an 18 to 24-year-old who has been on a universal credit for 6 months, and a £2,000 incentive for small businesses taking on an apprentice aged 16 to 24.
A Flintshire councillor has called the 2-year wait for the results of an investigation into the Cynfaid fire in Mold an unacceptable delay. Councillor David Coggins-Cogan wants Flintshire County Council's Chief Executive, Neil Cockerton, to press Natural Resources Wales, NRW, over its investigation into the blaze at the chemical plant on Denby Road, which remains unfinished more than 2 years on. The fire on the 30th of April 2024 led to multiple explosions and residents were warned to keep windows and doors closed. Synthite initially said no chemicals had been released, but around 50 dead fish were later found in the River Allen, and NRW confirmed traces of formaldehyde, a chemical produced at the plant, in the water. A report to councillors in May 2025 said the accident was being investigated by NRW and the Health and Safety Executive, HSE, as the joint regulator for sites handling dangerous substances. At the Corporate Resources Overview and Scrutiny Committee meeting, Councillor Coggins Cogan said, "I think it's an unacceptable delay." He also criticised the explanation originally given to the council that pollution entering the river was run off from water used by fire engines, saying it was foreseeable that water would be used to put out a fire at the site. Officers told the meeting the matter was already being actively pursued by the council's emergency planning team, which has a meeting with NRW and the HSE in the near future, and will push for a response as soon as possible. The May 2025 report also said that the fire service's own investigation had been submitted to the HSE in March 2025, and that NRW had secured environmental improvement at the Synthite site since the incident. In response, a spokesperson for NRW said, "Our investigation into the incident at Synthite Mould is in April 2024 remains ongoing. As this is an active investigation, we are unable to comment in detail at this stage in order to avoid prejudicing any potential regularity or enforcement action. We understand the concerns raised about the time taken and the desire for quicker answers. However, it is essential that our investigation is thorough, evidence-led, and capable of supporting any necessary regulatory action."
Flintshire has a bold new hub for businesses and creators to make their voice heard. Dragon Forge Studios has opened in Florence House in Mould, offering an affordable professional production environment unlike anything else in the region. Whether you're a business owner looking to build your brand or an individual ready to launch your first podcast, the studio provides a welcoming, high-quality setting to get started or grow your content. Rob Lewis, the award-winning financial advisor and managing director of Celtic Financial Planning, is behind the venture. He said, "There's a huge appetite for podcasting and video content, but when I looked into it, there were very few affordable local options. That's what sparked the idea, creating something accessible, flexible, and genuinely useful for people who want to get started or take their content to the next level." Rob developed the concept after struggling to find a suitable local venue to launch his own podcast. Joining him is renowned filmmaker and video coach Michael David Roberts of Take the Cake Productions, a respected figure in the regional creative industry with an extensive background in professional film and video production. Dragon Forge Studios represents an investment of more than £15,000 in modern professional-grade equipment, including high-quality speakers, microphones, a dedicated audio and visual production desk, and newly installed furniture throughout. The facility features a professional recording and presenting area, high-end lighting and sound, live streaming capability, and an adjoining green room alongside a breakout area with refreshments for individuals and teams alike. A range of packages is available to suit different needs and budgets. Clients can hire the facilities independently, bring their own production team, or opt for full support, including filming, editing, and interview hosting, with availability across daytime, evening, and weekend hours. It's about giving people options, Michael added. You can come in and do everything yourself, or we can support you with the full production. Either way, you're getting a professional result without having to invest thousands of pounds in your own setup.
A volunteer team which holds speeding motorists to account has now resumed activities. The Buckley Community Speed Watch team stood down for a period of time after its leader, Councillor Arnold Woolley, sustained an injury. He told the leader, "Now cleared from my injury, the Buckley Speed Watch team went roadside once more for an hour this afternoon, Friday. We did an hour from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. at our approved location on Altami Road, opposite the nursery school. The traffic was steaming along merrily, with hardly anyone bothering with the 20-mile-an-hour limit, until we put on our yellow jackets and displayed our radar guns, which incidentally were checked for accuracy by North Wales Police a week ago. The moment we became very visible in our yellow jackets and the drivers saw our radar guns, the entire pattern of speeding calmed down, with lots of headlight flashing up and down Old Timey Road as drivers tried to warn others that we were there. During the hour-long session, the team recorded 20 drivers doing above the 25-mile-an-hour tolerance level." Councillor Woolley added, "Most of those whose details we recorded and have since checked with the DVLA and then passed on to GoSafe and North Wales Police were between 27 and 30 miles an hour in that 20-mile-an-hour stretch of road. However, we did have vehicles doing speeds of 31 to 35 and one at 41 miles per hour. We did have one pedestrian ask us if we could be there more often, and a car driver stopped to tell us how awful the speeding along Old Tommy Road is when we're not there and to thank us for our efforts to calm down the traffic speeds."
13 million pound plan to build a new records office for Flintshire and Denbighshire next to Theatre Clwyd could be given the go-ahead by Christmas. An application for the National Lottery Heritage Fund to provide 7.3 million pounds of capital funding to deliver the project will be decided in December. If the bid is successful, work is expected to begin next year, with the record office completed by autumn 2028. If approved, that funding will be added to just over £3 million from Flintshire County Council, £2 million from Denbighshire County Council, and additional contributions from the Welsh Government to deliver the new joint record office. The facility will be situated next door to Theatre Clwyd and will house historical documents currently kept at Ruthin Jail and at Harden Rectory. As well as using digital technology to make records more accessible to visitors and researchers, the new facility will also work jointly with the theatre to bring history to life through performances and engagement projects, and it will also share the theatre facilities, including the cafe. Chief Officer for Education and Youth, Claire Homard, said, "This is the only proposal in the UK for an archive building to be co-located with a producing theatre. It brings an incredible opportunity to bring archive material to life by using the skills of our strategic partner, and some of that work's been undertaken already very successfully. We've had the Mould Riots outdoor performance in the town, and we've had monologues shown on the BBC based on records from the hospital in Denby. The National Lottery Heritage Fund see that as a real strength of the bid." Ms. Homard admitted that the number of staff required would reduce, but added that redundancies were not anticipated. She said, "The two teams in Harden and Ruthin work closely already, almost as one team, and this will give us a really efficient model and the opportunity for that expertise to be shared on a daily basis.
New toilets are planned for a Chester shopping centre after customer pleas. Customer toilets are finally making a return to Eastgate Square Shopping Centre in Chester City Centre. The facilities are being installed on the first floor of the former Topshop unit following repeated requests from shoppers. Designed with modern high-quality finishes, the new toilets are part of a wider programme of upgrades to Eastgate Square, formerly the Grosvenor Shopping Centre. Gary Martin, director of Martin Property Group, said, "This is one of those improvements that might sound simple, but it makes a huge difference to those visiting the centre. As we continue to invest in Eastgate Square, it's important that the space works for everyone, whether they're here for a quick visit or spending a few hours shopping, eating and enjoying the city." The new facilities are set to open this year. Lisa Rogers, centre manager at Eastgate Square, said, "We've heard the question more times than we can count, when are the toilets coming back? So it's incredibly satisfying to finally say that they are." These facilities will be modern, comfortable and located in a really convenient place for visitors. Alongside the wider improvements happening across the centre, they're another step towards making Eastgate Square a place people can rely on. Centre management believe the addition will encourage shoppers to stay longer and enjoy all that Eastgate Square has to offer. The upgrades are part of an ongoing effort to improve the overall visitor experience. An exact date for the opening of the new toilets has yet to be confirmed.
A Chester butcher shop is celebrating, as one of their pork pies has helped them retain a national victory. In 2023, S.J. Bevington Butchers of Chester, based in Five Ashes Road near Westminster Park, proudly won the title of Best Cold Eating Pie in the UK with their outstanding pork and apple pie at the Golden Cleaver Awards. And now, 3 years later, the butchers are back with victory in the competition with their Huntsman Pie, which is a pork pie stuffed with chicken and sage and onion. Andy Owen is manager of the shop, while Stuart Bebbington is the owner and George Lansley is a junior butcher. Andy and George were on hand to pick up the award at the Harrogate show, and the former admitted he was delighted with the win. He said, "Every 3 years, the Golden Cleaver Awards celebrate the very best products from independent butchers across the United Kingdom, recognising excellence, craftsmanship and innovation within the industry. We beat off more than 500 pies with our own Huntsman pie. We chose the Huntsman pie because it's one of our tastiest pies, so we thought it would be a strong choice, and we were right. It's a genuinely great achievement to be chosen over so many others. One of our other products made it to the final three of another competition too, but wasn't the final choice. But we're so proud of having two of our pies chosen to be in the last three for two different categories." Everyone at SJ Bevington Butchers would like to thank their loyal customers for their continued support and looks forward to welcoming both new and existing customers to try the award-winning Huntsman Pie.
Cheshire West and Chester Council has expressed surprise after it was stung with a £45,000 fine for what the Home Office said was employing an illegal worker. The government has published a list of businesses and other organisations it has hit with financial penalties for reportedly hiring staff who had no right to work in the UK. On the list is Cheshire West and Chester Council. which was apparently handed a fine of £45,000. The Home Office said that following a routine data share with HMRC, a civil penalty of £45,000 was issued to the council on November the 10th last year for employing what it said was one individual with no right to work in the UK. Civil penalty notices can include fines of up to £45,000 per illegal worker for an initial breach, rising to a maximum of £60,000 for repeat offences. A Home Office spokeswoman said, "Illegal working undermines honest employers, undercuts local wages, and fuels organised immigration crime. This government will not stand for it." She added, "Since coming into power, we have increased immigration enforcement action to the highest level in British history. This has delivered an 83% rise in illegal working arrests and 77% rise in raids." But the council said it is currently none the wiser about the fine or about what it is for. In a statement, a council spokesperson said, "We have no knowledge or record of illegal workers, and we are currently in the process of contacting the Home Office."
A Chester care village and its nursery will feature on legendary BBC religion show Songs of Praise later this month. Multiple generations' voices filled the air when BBC Songs of Praise attended the Belong Chester care village in City Road to film the episode about faith and what people of different ages can learn from each other. A focus of the visit was a performance by the Sankofa Songsters Intergenerational Choir, led by Amanda Ridley of Live the Beat, bringing together village residents, children from the on-site nursery, and members of the wider community, including pupils from the Hall Church of England Primary School. The choir features members aged from 2 to 102. Caroline Ray, General Manager at Belong Chester, said, "It was a joy to welcome Songs of Praise to witness the magic that happens when different generations come together." The visit highlighted the unique model as the UK's first care village to incorporate a fully integrated research nursery, the Ready Generations Nursery in Belong, with children and residents sharing daily life to improve well-being, reduce isolation, and foster lifelong learning. Apart from the music, the film crew captured the daily rhythm of life at the village, including shared experiences such as flower arranging, art sessions, gardening, and prambles, where residents and nursery teams go on walks with the children in prams. Presenter Claire McCullum chatted to residents, colleagues, and children. The episode also explored how the village supports the spiritual lives of those in its community. In line with its values, Belong promotes an environment where everyone can be comfortable in who they are, welcoming people of all faiths and none. Anyone moving into the village is given the opportunity to share their faith along with the other details about themselves and their life in order for teams to better support them to continue to live how they wish. The episode will be broadcast on BBC One on Sunday, June the 28th at 1:15 p.m.
Chester is gearing up to host a very different global tournament this summer, and this one comes with bells on. 25 town choirs from across the globe will descend on the city this September for the World Town Choir Tournament. Organisers Marketing Cheshire have confirmed this. The details were announced, fittingly, by Chester Town Choir David Mitchell. This event will be loud, will be colourful, it will be eccentric, and it will be free, he declared. Competitors spanning England, the Channel Islands, Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Canada, the United States and Australia will go head to head from September the 22nd to the 26th, with each choir judged across three rounds on a different theme. Jamie Christen, Chair of Marketing Cheshire and CEO of Chester Zoo, said, "The World Town Choir Tournament is exactly the kind of event that puts Chester on the map. 25 competitors from across the globe, free to watch, right in the heart of the city. It doesn't get much better than that." The opening round features a hometown cry, with competitors showcasing where they come from. Judging criteria cover vocal proficiency, confidence and bearing, content and audience engagement. Rounds will take place at Town Hall Square, Eastgate Square and Exchange Square. Special awards include Best Dressed Choir, Best Dressed Consort, Best Dressed Couple and Best Ambassador. A daily winner will be selected throughout the week, with the overall champion crowned on the final day. Marketing Cheshire secured a grant from Airbnb's Best of British Fund to stage the event, its first World Town Choir Tournament since 2014, to help showcase the city to a national and international audience. Full details of the tournament, including participants, countries and backgrounds, are available on Visit Cheshire's dedicated World Town Choir Tournament page.
Families receiving support from charities were gifted a day to remember at the annual Roman Day event at Chester Racecourse on Saturday 30th of May. For the fifth year running, the MBNA Bank's Community Investment Programme worked in partnership with the racecourse to create a memorable experience for 160 families from Koala Northwest, Cheshire Young Carers and North Wales Super Kids. The special guests were invited to attend the popular summer fixture combining live racing with a packed programme of immersive entertainment and activities for youngers. This year's activities included Roman stunt shows, gladiator boot camps, Camp Curiosity's interactive outdoor learning camp, themed crafts, Roman artifacts and activities delivered with Chester Heritage Festival, alongside live music and entertainment across the course. Families were also treated to a complimentary picnic lunch and hosted within a dedicated reserve area on the open course, giving them a comfortable space to relax and enjoy the day together. MBNA colleagues and volunteers supported the event throughout the day, helping to welcome guests and assist with activities across the venue. Victoria Dowd, MBNA Community Investment Partnership Manager, said Roman Day is always such a brilliant event and one we love getting involved with year after year. It's fantastic to see so many young people and families getting involved in the activities and enjoying the atmosphere together. From racing to the Roman-themed entertainment, there's so much for families to experience throughout the day, and we're really proud to be able to support local charities by helping make days like this possible. Kate Dawson, Commercial Director at Chester Racecourse, said our partnership with MBNA helps us open up days like Roman Day to more local charities each year. Roman Day is always a standout fixture, and there's a great atmosphere across the racecourse from start to finish. It's fantastic to see so many families enjoying everything the day has to offer, from the incredible entertainment through to the immersive themed activities that really bring Chester's Roman heritage to life.
The zoo has welcomed a rare northern giraffe, and they hope he'll prove to be quite the catch. Chris, a lively three-year-old male, has travelled from West Midlands Safari Park to meet the zoo's resident female herd. His introduction has been carefully planned, with conservationists matching the animals based on genetics, age and temperament. The keepers are hopeful that his arrival will help to produce calves and strengthen the conservation breeding program for the northern giraffe, which is one of the world's most endangered species. Fewer than 7,000 northern giraffes remain in the wild, the decline of the species being driven by habitat loss, poaching, and conflict with humans. Rosie Owen, giraffe keeper at Chester Zoo, said, "Chris's arrival marks the beginning of an important new chapter for our herd here at Chester. At just over 3 years old, Chris is still a young giraffe, but he's full of confidence and he's already getting to know the herd. And out of his five new housemates, four of them are older females who are all considerably taller than him. He's taking everything in his stride and we're optimistic that in time our matchmaking will pay off and he'll go on to play a vital role in helping to save his species from extinction." Stuart Nixon, African conservation expert at the zoo, added, "For more than a decade, we've supported our in-country partners, the Giraffe Conservation Foundation and the Ugandan Wildlife Authority, in their efforts to protect and recover populations of the Nubian giraffe, a subspecies of the northern giraffe and one of the most threatened giraffes in all of Africa. This work has seen the Nubian giraffe population increase by more than 600 individuals over the last 10 years, with numbers now continuing to increase year on year. The recovery of the Nubian giraffe in Uganda is a massive success story, and it really shows what science-led conservation can achieve." Well, we hope that you found our selection of news items of interest this week. I'd like to thank our readers, Jan, Helen, Esther, Margaret, Sarah, and Patrick. And also, I'd like to thank Owen, who will be putting this edition together and uploading it later tonight. So now I'd just like to invite all of our readers to join me in saying goodbye to end this live portion of this week's edition. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
A day in the life of singer Billy Ocean. Born Leslie Sebastian Charles, Ocean, 76, was raised in Trinidad and Tobago. He moved with his family to Romford in East London, aged 10. He worked as a tailor before having his first hit in 1976 with the song "Love Really Hurts Without You." A series of number one singles followed, including "When the Going Gets Tough" and "Caribbean Queen." He has sold more than 30 million records. He lives in Berkshire with his wife Judy and they have three grown-up children. He says, "I like to stay in bed in the morning. We've got workmen in at the moment because we have a serious water leak. The carpet was like a rainforest and I have to be up at 7, but it's killing me. I go for a swim in the morning, but I don't bother washing my dreadlocks. Once a month is fine. Your hair looks after itself, I think. Breakfast is just toast and a cup of tea. No bacon, no sausage. I stopped eating meat after my mother died in 1989. She had stomach cancer and I was sure it had to do with all the meat that we eat. West Indians have meat with everything. Coincidentally, her passing brought me closer to Jesus. The music business can be crazy at times and the Bible gives me an anchor. People say, I can't read the Bible, I don't understand it. But that's okay because the Bible understands you. It knows what to say to you. I have always loved music, but in Trinidad the opportunities were limited. Girls became mothers, boys worked on the farm or started drinking. Taking us to the East End of London in 1960 was my dad's attempt to make a better life for our family. We were part of the Windrush generation and yes, race was an issue. In Trinidad, black and white kids didn't mix, but white kids were suddenly my schoolmates. Not everyone in London had nice things to say to us, but it was part of life, and to an extent it still is. I choose to concentrate on myself, and not what that guy over there thinks. Music helped to ease the racial tensions in the 60s and the 70s. If you saw a black person on Top of the Pops, it broke down some barriers. I was making my way as a Savile Row tailor when "Love Really Hurts Without You" became a big hit in 1976. I could see people looking at me and they were about to say something nasty, but then they thought, hang on, it's the guy who sings that song. Fame felt fantastic and also frightening. The world treats you differently. And I suddenly had money. This'll sound a bit pretentious, but I picked up my Bible and read about when God asked Solomon what he wished for. He didn't ask for riches or power, he asked for knowledge and wisdom. I tried to put the money to good use, buying my mum a house, making sure the family was healthy. My wife isn't vegetarian, so I do a lot of my own cooking. Every few weeks I go up to Shepherd's Bush and I buy Western Indian ingredients like yams, green bananas and callaloo. I think my curries are pretty good. At 76, I could put my feet up, but that seems like such a waste. Music is a spiritual thing. It's like a carpenter making furniture or a baker baking bread. There aren't as many things being thrown at the stage, but that's quite okay. The audience is smiling and so am I. My daughter Cherie sings with me and my other daughter Rachel is a teacher. My son Anthony is a fitness instructor. They've got used to what I do. There are some funny moments when one of their friends will say that their mum used to have my poster on their wall, because I used to look pretty sharp. When I look at all these new artists, I think to myself, I hope they're not doing it for the money, because I think it has to come from the heart. If I'd stayed in the rag trade, I'd still be singing. If I have a free evening, I might tidy the garden or watch a nature documentary. I go to bed about 10 and I take a moment to offer a prayer. Not every day is perfect. A few years ago, I was arrested and accused of being a drug dealer. The police saw a black man with dreadlocks and made their assumptions. But age is a beautiful thing. I can look at those days now and laugh. I have my family and my music. I am happy and I sleep well at night. This was adapted from an article in the Sunday Times magazine of Sunday, May the 31st, 2026.
FIFA bans reusable water bottles at the World Cup. FIFA has banned reusable bottles from this summer's World Cup due to concerns that they could be thrown at players or staff. The organisation has made changes to its stadium code of conduct and is now banning fans from bringing bottles, cups, jars and cans into games. FIFA said it's committed to protecting the health and safety of all players, referees, fans, volunteers and staff. Experts are concerned that there won't be enough access to water for fans coping with this summer's heat, but FIFA said that fans will be able to buy water in the stadiums.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This article of Good News for Parasport has been written by Heather and is read by Alastair Hutton. Parasport has been in the headlines recently with two major announcements that will help UK athletes prepare for the next Paralympics in 2028. First is the chance for our para-athletes to gain valuable experience of international competition at this year's Commonwealth Games, which will start in Glasgow on the 23rd of July 2026. And second is the allocation of significant extra funding from UK Sport to support training and development for competitors who hope to represent Team GB at the 2028 Paralympics in Los Angeles. Glasgow's decision to host this year's Commonwealth Games offered a lifeline for the competition after the original Australian hosts pulled out because of rising costs. Although the Glasgow event will be slightly smaller than other recent Commonwealth Games, there'll be a record number of parasports medals to be won. There'll be 47 para medals up for grabs across six parasports, and for the first time ever, a parasport powerlifting will receive the first medal of the competition. The other five para competitions in Glasgow will be 3x3 wheelchair basketball, para athletics, para bowls, para swimming, and para track cycling. And in another first for Glasgow, the medals awarded will be the first Commonwealth Games medals to feature Braille. Olympic and Paralympic medals have previously included Braille, but this is the first time it's been used at the Commonwealth Games. The medals have been designed by artist Milica Milikova from the Glasgow School of Art, and in addition to Braille lettering, the triangular-shaped medals also include other tactile features celebrating Glasgow, such as the Finiston Crane landmark and tartan. Now, looking further ahead to the 2028 Paralympics in Los Angeles, UK Sport has announced funding boosts for several parasports to help our athletes prepare. In total, an additional £4 million is being provided this year, divided between 16 sports. The biggest winner from the extra funding is climbing, which will receive an extra £1.4 million. That's a 60% increase, because UK Sport believes it is a discipline where the UK has significant future medal potential. As part of the new funding for climbing, paraclimbing, included in the 2028 Paralympics for the first time, will receive £500,000. At the top of the table for total funding in the parasport world are para-athletics and para-swimming. While the £9.8 million funding for para-athletics is not set to benefit from the newly announced extra funding, an additional £45,000 for para-swimming will see their total funding rise to £9.2 million. Other parasports gaining from a share of the extra £4 million include VI Judo, receiving an extra £202,500, and Para Badminton, gaining an extra £193,600. Para Canoeing will receive an extra £112,000, and Wheelchair Fencing will receive an extra £32,000. UK Sport says the money will play a critical part in enabling British athletes to deliver their best performances in the USA in 2 years' time. The organisation stressed that this funding is essential to ensuring that Britain can continue to compete in the top rank of Olympic and Paralympic sport.
TNS Soundings.
Former Prime Minister of Australia, Julia Gillard, talks about her life. Julia Gillard, 64, was born in Barry in Wales, but she moved to Adelaide in Australia with her family as a child. She became Deputy Prime Minister in 2007 and in 2010 became the first female Prime Minister of Australia, a position she held until 2013. She is now chair of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College in London. She divides her time between Adelaide and London. She says, "The world misses President Obama's leadership. I spent a lot of time with Obama. He was my counterpart. He is a truly decent human being. He's a very kind, thoughtful leader and someone I saw constantly treat everyone around him with decency and respect. He really exuded that. When he came to Australia, he said hello to every one of the attendants who stood at the doors in Parliament House. I do think that Australia will become a republic, but that is many a long year away. The stuff that got sent to me on social media was often violent, threatening or toxic. My time in politics coincided with the social media starting to become a dominant form of political discourse. I didn't feel a huge amount of sexism or misogyny until I was Prime Minister. I was conscious that I was going into a very male-dominated place. In the top job, the gendered insult became the go-to political weapon. Frustration with that is what led me to give the 2012 misogyny speech in Parliament, which has been viewed by millions of people. I am very supportive of the ban on social media for under-16s in Australia. Creating a new norm where no young teenagers are on it frees them to do more productive things with that time. Hillary Clinton is a friend. I continue to be in close contact with her. She was very popular in Australia. I remember Australians standing up and applauding her as she walked by. A senior government figure referred to me as deliberately barren. It caused quite an incident and ultimately he apologised.
women in leading positions are judged by a different standard and there is much more focus on family structures. I am a fan of the TV comedy Gavin and Stacey. I'm hoping to go on a Gavin and Stacey tour in Barry in Wales, where I was born. My sister and I do muse about what would have happened if we'd stayed in Wales. Knitting at the end of the day helped me to wind down from my frenzied political life and to move on from being 100% on to being ready to sleep, because it's rhythmic and it takes some of your attention. Wanting to send Australia's good wishes and a gift on the birth of baby Prince George coincided with a period where I was knitting, so it all came together and I knitted a kangaroo for Prince George in 2013. Even though neither of my parents finished secondary school, they were both avid readers. That was passed on to my sister and me. In our family, the weekly walk to the public library to change over our books was a ritual, and that passion has stayed with me. When I was in politics at the highest levels, I didn't have that much time for reading. I took the perspective that if I was awake enough to be reading, I was awake enough to be working. My nose was in cabinet documents rather than routinely in a book. One of the great delights of my life in this phase is finding far more time for reading and being involved with the Women's Prize for Fiction. I discovered feminism at university. I was absolutely persuaded that men and women weren't treated equally and that change was needed. But I was also a huge optimist. When I was 20, I would have said, but all that'll be fixed by the time I'm 40, because everybody's onto it now. But then I discovered that it wasn't quite that easy. We need women in politics. I don't want to put women off politics. I overwhelmingly look back at my political career as an honour and a privilege. If there was a time machine and I was offered the chance to go back and do it all again, and every day was going to play out the same, would I do it? Absolutely I would, in a heartbeat. This was adapted from an article in The Times magazine of Saturday, the 6th of June, 2026.
And now for some news from Telford. Long lost letter found. A letter written by Sir Richard Owen, the scientist who coined the word dinosaur, has been discovered, tucked inside an old book. The letter will go on display at Telford's Exotic Zoo as part of the Telford Fossil Festival. Owen wrote the letter to a fellow paleontologist, that is a scientist who studies fossils, asking to borrow some fossilised bones for research. The letter has only just been rediscovered after being lost for years.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
So here we are on a riverside wheelchair wander with Lindsay. On a partially sunny day, we're going to start off crossing the railway. So we're just going to stop and listen for a train. Doesn't appear to be one in front of me. It's a ship's captain painted in a white triangle, and he's using a sextant, which of course they used to navigate in olden times. Now, the old malt houses have been changed into flats and residential. Before me is the small, I suppose, quay. There's lots of different types of boats here, houseboats. There's some narrow boats, some barges which have been converted into houseboats. They are very much stationary. In fact, I can see one with a for sale sign, which is an estate agent. And I suppose that's what you would use to sell a houseboat. One big boat is called Seafarer. We've gone past the haulage crane, which they use during the winter months to lift out the boats and bring on shore. And we're now going to go round to the tide mill. Now we've come to the Woodbridge Museum on our left, which has a big sign saying Discover Woodbridge, and it's presumably got everything that's relevant to the town. It also has the long shed where the old boatyard used to be and was quite well renowned. There seems to be, for some reason, two massive tree trunks sitting on their forecourt. I would say almost 30 foot long, and they're about 2.5 to 3 foot wide. I'm guessing oak, but I could be wrong on that. And presumably they're going to plank them up and use that for actually making a wooden boat. The Boathouse Cafe looks busy. This is going to be interesting. We're on a bit of a slant. The River Deben, which is what we're next to, seems to be quite murky today. It's got a lot of algae and general. Let's put it this way, the water's not that clear. There's some building work going on next to the tide mill, which you can probably hear. There is actually a boat, and I'm going to try and pronounce it. I think it's Seawafling, which is a longboat replica that they've actually got sitting on the water. It's done in black. It's got a nice ribbed underneath, and you can see the ribbing inside the boat, and it's got some rigging. It's quite small looking in the water, but I'm sure it is actually quite a big boat. It all relates to Sutton Hoo, which is on the opposite bank of the river and holds the museum for the 7th century King Redwald. It's famous for its archaeological dig, which they found remains of the king's treasure in a buried 90-foot long ship. And the National Museum in London displays the original Sutton Hoo treasure, which consists of a helmet, a shield, and a sword. And it's very Scandinavian in design. So it's a cross between Anglo-Saxon and Scandinavian art. The landowner of the time when the archaeological dig was taking place was Mrs. Pretty, who basically dug up her back garden. This was just before World War II, and she'd had a premonition that there was something, and it was rumoured that when they were doing the excavation the first time round, that one valuable belt buckle, which was encrusted with rubies and other gemstones, she kept in a shoebox under her bed. Of course, later, when the second dig took place after World War II, it had to be declared, along with the rest of the treasure, to the UK authorities. Now, the tide mill, which we've just passed, was built in 1170, along with a priory, which was run by Augustine monks. But, of course, King Henry VIII took it over in 1536, and Queen Elizabeth I then bequeathed it to a lawyer of the town who used the money and the profits from the mill to build almshouses for the poor. So it did have quite a good legacy. It's now a working museum, and it's only one of two working tide mills left in the UK. And they work as the tide of the river changes, so as it flows in and flows out, it actually causes a water wheel to turn on the outside of the building. Very large water wheel. And that churns up the water and creates power, which that goes through cogs and gears, which filter down into turning the grinding stones at the bottom, which make flour from various grains like wheat, barley, even oats, if they want to. At the tide mill, it has behind it a privately owned marina, so you can pay to park your yachts and your boats in there. And they are actually utilising what used to be the larger area of the mill pond. So it's only got a small demonstration-sized pond now. It has a sort of Dutch style, I guess, the tide mill. Peaked roof, white boarded, and it's got a couple of tiny weeny little windows to let in light. But of course, it's mainly for producing flour for the local bakeries. We've now reached Woodbridge Railway Station, which was opened in 1859 and designed by architect Frederick Barnes. Now, he specifically moved to Suffolk following another designer friend and ended up designing local railway stations for the whole of Suffolk. But then again, where we are currently situated in Woodbridge, the railway station is only 79 miles from London, so it is a good commuter train. Although Woodbridge Town, of course, is well known as a riverside, picturesque, and I suppose what would be called quaint town, it was registered in the Domesday Book in 1086 as Port of Lowe's Hundred, and they were renowned for importing corn, coal, and timber. Now, ironically, back in the 1980s, they closed down the last coal yard distribution centre at the next railway station down in Melton, which is an adjoining village. Also, on the Melton side, where the river narrows, they put a bridge across, a stone bridge, to give access to Sutton Hoo. And to my right, if you go out and you follow the river round, you do actually come to the widest part, which joins with the sea, hence it being tidal. But of course, at low tide, there's a lot of mud flats which are exposed, and this encourages wetland bird life, such as curlews, redshanks, avocets, lapwings, and then the more common brent geese, ducks, swans. And on occasion, I have seen grey seals make their way up the river, and I believe there are some sea otters about as well. And that is why all the waterway users are told to be aware and to not disturb any nesting bird sites. We're going to move up now to the Woodbridge Cruising Club. The clubhouse itself is quite modern looking. It's got a sort of a balconied lookout type square building to the left. And then to the right, it's got more of a sort of a village hall feel about it. It began in 1965 and they charged membership at 10 shillings, which in today's money would be about 50p. Probably unwisely, we are actually heading into the storm. There's not many people about, but who are about are quite wrapped up considering it's spring. They're in their little jackets and their woolly hat. Oh, this is nice. The cruising club have got a rockery / graveled sort of alpine plant area with some seaside tolerant plants and some heathers and some gorse bushes. So we've got a gorse bush, well, looks like a gorse bush, but has little purple flowers. So I don't know what that is. Some heathers with some bright sort of vermilion pink, traditional gorse bushes with yellow flowers. And then sort of white daisies, very tiny head in this sort of scrubland, and a plant that looks like seaweed, but on land. And some grasses too. Oh, and in amongst all of this is a rusty old ship's anchor, about 3 foot by 3 foot, roughly. Obviously iron. Hello. Come on. I've just been greeted by a very elderly cocker spaniel, which is white with brown splotches on. And he was just pleased to see anybody, I think, other than its owner on this walk. I'm actually going along the wider concrete sort of promenade section of the riverside bank now. Every now and then there is a drop-down sort of balcony, if you like, concrete balcony, where they've put benches out so people can actually step down off the promenade section and just sit, but be out of the main thoroughfare section. And I do often see people picnicking, and artists quite often come down here to paint as well. We don't get too much seagull activity, so it is quite good not to have seagulls pestering you every 5 minutes. In front of me is the Devon Rowing Club building, which is all done in black boarding, shiplap, with narrow windows, almost like a workshop. The window frames have been painted red to stand out, and they've got little upper windows which they've put grills across, like a Juliet balcony. and they've put circles within those grills, which is a bit weird because it looks more like a cycle shed than it does a rowing boat. As we come along the promenade, there is the Deben Yacht Club. It's just basically shed on stilts, which goes actually out into the water, and they have their own jetties and ramps which go into the water, and it's from here that they have the flags fluttering on regatta day and have the klaxons and everything that go off to signify the races, and they put out all the buoys into the river to mark the course that the boats are supposed to travel around. If we were to carry on a little bit further, we were going to the more wilderness side of Riverside Walk, barely wide enough for two people to be side by side. So we're not going to go down there because we will clog up the walkway for the pedestrians because my wheelchair is not really narrow enough. But at the end of that is Kyson Point, which is a little piece of land which juts out and has a sandy beach. If you go up onto the hill, there is a bench and there is a coastal fire beacon, a wooden post upright with a metalwork basket on the top, of which they put flammable materials in like wood and straw and light that to warn people and boats of any approaching enemy. And they were used mainly during the time of the Spanish Armada and Napoleonic Wars. But of course, they are used for ceremonial reasons these days. I believe the last time this one was lit was 2012 for Queen Elizabeth II's Diamond Jubilee. And it was one of over 4,200 coastal beacons that were lit. Well, as the weather closes in, I shall now wind my way back to the car park. And so I will say, I hope you enjoyed the wheelchair wander. Bye for now.
TNF Soundings.
Screenwriter Julian Fellowes talks about his life. The screenwriter Lord Julian Fellowes, 76, was born in Cairo and grew up in East Sussex. After graduating from Cambridge, he became an actor before winning an Academy Award for writing the film Gosford Park. His subsequent TV series, Downton Abbey and The Gilded Age, have won several BAFTAs and Golden Globes. He lives in Dorset and London with his wife Emma Joy Kitchener. They have a son, Peregrine. He says, "I wasn't good looking enough to be a successful actor, although one should never make firm rules. Maggie Smith wasn't Ava Gardner to look at, but she is very exciting to watch. Looking back, I don't think I had anything to sell that 50 other actors couldn't have done just as well. I think we live too long now. I've got spinal stenosis, so I can't stand or walk for any length of time. I'm in a wheelchair quite a lot because I kept falling over. If, like our ancestors, we died at 65, we would miss all this. Assisted dying is hard for me to take on as a Catholic. I don't believe it's our business to take life, and I'm afraid that a great many vulnerable people will be pressured into ending theirs. Politicians always seem to think that the public are much stupider than they really were. I think you should get out of the country that you've grown up in just for a while. Go and be a waiter in a cafe in Spain or something. It gives you a chance to look back at the world that you're living in. I went to Colombia at 18. I was put on an oil tanker and sent across the Atlantic. When I got back, I took a very different person to Cambridge. My mother was a great beauty and she was very funny. That gave my father confidence. His relations didn't understand that. They saw her as having caught him. She wasn't exactly selling violets in Covent Garden, but she did come from a less grand family. And he, having grown up as a rather ignored little boy, suddenly had this wife who was very social and the centre of everything. Those two counter-influences really shaped me and made me look at society. Most people who make a success of their lives don't mourn their failures for too long. They move on. You didn't get this job, you didn't get that girl. Whatever it is, the answer is, watch a great video, have a good cry, eat a takeaway, move on. My father whipped me once. I was very angry about something and I picked up a pot of baked beans and threw it against the wall. I heard him growl and I knew I was in for it. I can't honestly say I blame him much. I had mixed feelings about my son getting into show business. Peregrine is a producer and an actor. The other day, Rafe Spall, who's a good actor, the son of Timothy Spall, said, "Oh, I don't believe we should help anyone from Eton." And I wanted to say to him, "Do you have any idea how great an advantage it is to be the son of a successful actor? That's far more of an unfair help than coming from the best private school in England." Alzheimer's disease steals people's personalities. I have close relations who have been diagnosed with it, and while experts say 1 in 3 of us is going to get it, 3 in 3 of us are going to be involved with someone who's got it. Watching someone's personality being stolen by that disease is very hard. They become almost a stranger. Would I write a Downton spin-off? Well, a lifetime in show business has taught me never to say never. I've been lucky to be able to work on projects that have interested me and they have pleased enough of the public. I take my hat off to Maggie Smith and women like her, who made it and remain serious actresses. When I started, it was hard for actresses. They had to fight to be taken seriously. The producers who are now accused of using their position to abuse people sexually are picking up the bill for 1,000 producers since the coming of sound. This was adapted from an article in the Times magazine of Saturday the 30th of May 2026.
And now for some news from Ashford in Kent. World's smallest cat to get new enclosure. The Big Cat Sanctuary in Kent will soon be home to the UK's largest purpose-built habitat for the rusty spotted cat, the world's smallest wildcat species. The sanctuary has built a new rusty spotted cat conservation centre, which features 3 5-metre-high outdoor enclosures connected by walkways. Each enclosure is themed to reflect the cat's native habitats across India, Sri Lanka and Nepal. They will also feature specialised UV lighting, climate-controlled heat zones and automated rainfall systems to support the cat's welfare.
Hello once again, this is Michael Jones with some more summertime poems. This one's called The Sea Wall. The place was drenched in sunlight, everything locked into summertime. Sky bright and clear, electric blue, pollen count the scent of summer, the streets overheating, the windows charged with colour. The bars are full, the doors thrown open, the temperatures go higher, the paint is peeling, people perspire. And heading for the coast one day, we felt the heat wave on its way. We stripped down and climbed over rocks, and skimmed our stones and let the sand run through our hands. And set free on the shore, we felt the breeze on our faces, and the tide drew us in to the dream, the salt, the spray and the sea wall, wherein we were found many years from now, somewhere down there with the lost and the drowned. A lifetime of sand. Amazing how these old towns still have time for the human side. The young people running along the beach. The crowds gathered in the bars. The brightly coloured hotels all along the front. The great British public sunning themselves on the old promenade. From the child in the pram to the elderly man. The wind blows across a lifetime of sand. And I came across the shape of a heart, carved in the shingle by an unknown hand. From Forties Cafe to the big blue sky, it's the people who came here, dodging the rain and following the sun, watching the sea splashing onto the shore. The crash of the waves goes on and on. And finally, Slogan Summer. Hot and bewildered, the summer months, the open season, endure the hypertension and all that can happen, short-tempered engines overheating. Pedestrians thronged the same city streets, those that steamed beneath the summer heat and ground their teeth and stamped their feet. The crowds filled the air with slogans and issues, trespassing on the olden days in a heated exchange with the law, the money, and the history of the place. The demonstration grew and grew, spokesmen, placards, and loud hailers too, gave voice to their opinions, as people do. Pressure groups meet in the bar, leaflets, manifestos make that speech. Soapbox rhetoric, union membership, vox pops to its logical conclusion. Every man on the march to his democratic vote, his final destination.
Government vows to cut greenhouse gas emissions. The government says it aims to cut UK greenhouse gas emissions by 87% by 2040 compared to 1990 levels. The plan has been set out in the 7th carbon budget, a legal agreement to limit emissions between 2038 and 2042. The UK would need to invest £880 billion over 25 years to achieve the target. But the Climate Change Committee says that it would produce almost double that in benefits, including improving air quality, our quality of life, and tackling climate change. Greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide trap heat in the atmosphere, leading to global warming.